Coming to you live from my palatial mansion, I'm Chip Bove. And with me, as always, are my adoring fans.
We love you, Chip!
Sign my boobies, Chip!
And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 50 Billion, Creamed Corn and Salami, A Cautionary Tale.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast, everybody. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Chip Bove.
Chip Bove's here.
Surprise!
Yay! Yes, everyone, our favorite person, Chip Bove, is back once again.
Our best friend.
Our best friend
in
the whole wide world.
Our financial benefactor.
Exactly. He's back once again to tell us about stuff that we don't know much about because he is a clever man.
Unlike Tom, who, while gesturing on an audio-only medium, just hit his own mic stand.
I have to admit, it's great to be back, although technically I never left. I've actually just been staying in the green room since we last recorded about a year ago.
Chip's room.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes.
Is that where all the honey roasted peanuts have been going?
That's I'm afraid that's true. Yes.
Delivered by the truckload through the back.
Yeah, I wondered about that, but I didn't want to ask because the delivery guy had like a mustache. It was kind of a scary one, so I didn't want to talk to him.
Tom's afraid of mustaches, including but not limited to the one that lives on his upper lip.
That's a caterpillar.
Oh, I stand corrected.
Well, fortunately, he also has a fear of caterpillars, so everything works out in the end.
Really just...
He's just constantly terrified.
That's true.
Well, Chip is back on with us, not just in his room, but actually on mic, because he has another game coming out shortly. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. My next game is going to be called Universal Rule, and it's another wallet game. So it's the same size and format as Smoke and Mirrors, which we talked about a year ago.
Yeah.
So it's another game in Button Shy's line of wallet games. They've been releasing one a month this year in 2016. And so Universal Rule is going to be on Kickstarter starting November 1st and running to about November 12th. Universal Rule is a 4X game. So the four X's in the class of games called 4X games are expand, explore,
and
exploit,
arithmetic.
And sometimes, no, and exterminate is the last one. So there are a lot of really good and interesting 4X games out there. I think Eclipse is probably one of the best known ones. You know, basically anything where you're building up a civilization, you're starting with, you know, just one guy and a pickaxe, and eventually you're building nuclear weapons and trying to destroy your opponents. The idea of Universal Rule is that it hits all the same notes as a much longer and much larger game, but does it using only 18 cards and a playtime around 30 to 45 minutes.
We were impressed. We were looking at the Board Game Geek page that you linked us to, trying to figure out how on earth you do a 4X game with 18 cards.
Yeah, it's interesting because after Smoke and Mirrors, I was talking with Jason Tagmeier, who's the guy behind Button Shy Games, and I had a couple other ideas I wanted to pitch to him, and he said he was really looking for something meatier, like a 4X game, and my immediate reaction was, you know, using only 18 cards, that's just flat out impossible. And then about a week or two later, I came back to him and said, well, here's how I would do it. And, you know, we sort of started the conversation from there. So the game's been in development for about about a year now. One of the things that was useful is Gil Hova runs a program called 4P. And the idea of this is every January to take a new design, or even an old design, but something you haven't worked on in a while, and commit to yourself that you will run 4 playtests of that game during the month of January. So I sort of took the initial idea I had for Universal Rule and decided to use that format to really test the idea and see the feasibility, as it were, of creating a 4X game with the restrictions of using only 18 cards and a handful of tokens. Mm-hmm. So that went well. I did a lot of development over the course of that month. And a few months later, I then officially submitted it to Buttonshy and pitched it to them. And then I would say maybe a month or a month and a half after that, they accepted it. And then we've sort of been working on the game together since then.
Cool. When you were saying Jason Tagmeier had said he was kind of hoping for a bigger 4X style game, did he actually think that was going to be in the wallet games format, or did you just like, that seems like a tall order?
Yes. And we were specifically talking about the wallet game format.
Okay.
And I had pitched him like a couple lighter games. Uh-huh. And he was really sort of looking to expand his audience, because he'd already sort of built up a good fan base for lighter games, for social deduction games, for games that don't take themselves too seriously.
Uh-huh.
And so we really wanted to sort of see how far we could push the envelope with a deeper game, not an introductory game, but more of a gamer's game, and still, have the restriction of just using 18 cards.
That's interesting. I'm brain fart. How many players? No, 3 to 5 players. It's right in front of my face. We've enjoyed the wallet games that we backed the last time, which was North Southeast Quest, Smoke and Mirrors. And the other one we haven't gotten to play yet.
That would be Fever Chill is, I think, the third one.
And the problem we've run into, which is probably a function of making it out of 18 cards or fewer, is that they don't support a large player count. And
yes.
So at the times when we have people available to play games with us, we usually have 5 to 7 people to play games with, and so it's Fever Chill is out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, player count is really interesting. For Universal Rule, it really does need at least 3 players, because you really want, there's a lot of interaction between the players.
Mm-hmm.
And with just 2 players, you lose out a lot on negotiating and figuring out who's the biggest threat, because there's really only one other person that you're trying to play against. I think that 4 people is probably the ideal number of players for Universal Rule. But I've done a lot of testing with 3 and 5, and it certainly works with those player counts, although it has a different experience. So for example, if you're attacking someone, everyone in the game is involved in every attack. So there's the attacker, the defender, and then the other players that are involved have the opportunity to support either the attacker or the defender. And they also have incentives for doing each of those things.
Reminds me of Cosmic Encounter a little bit with that mechanic.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. At its best, Universal Rule provides a very similar feel to Cosmic Encounter.
I'm sold.
Where The attacking thing is particularly interesting because I think another comparison that I would be really happy with is something like diplomacy. In order for when you're attacking in Universal Rule, you often need to work together to create alliances with other players to prevent one player that's gotten too far ahead from just winning the game. Mm-hmm. However, you don't want to, if you use up all of your resources in an attack, you'll then be susceptible to someone counterattacking, and then, you know, you don't have any of the credits, which is the currency in the game, mm-hmm. or cards in your hand to use to defend. However, if you don't use enough resources to stop the current player, your attack might not be successful. So it's the sort of thing where you want to cooperate enough to prevent one player from running away from the game, but you also may want to sort of either backstab or not commit as many resources as you said you were going to hold them back, uh-huh. and then claim victory for yourself. So it's there's a lot of sort of emergent dynamics involved in the attacking part of the game.
Could you run us through like the basic play of the game, like maybe what a turn looks sure. like, just to sure. give us an idea of how it goes?
So there are two mechanically interesting things that I'll talk about. So one of them, which I've already really covered, is attacking, and the other is following. So this is a 4X game, and as I have said, the X is the actions that you could take on your turn correspond to those 4Xs. So exploring is drawing a card from the deck, and that gives you another, every card has a planet on it. So exploring is getting a card into your hand, so you're finding out information about that planet. Mm-hmm. Another action you could take is colonizing. So that's playing a card that you've discovered to the table. So adding it to your tableau. Now you have the resources available associated with that planet. Mm-hmm. And you have whatever the special ability each planet has. Almost every planet has a special ability that bends one of the rules in the game. Again, similar to games like Cosmic Encounter. Another option that you have for your action is to upgrade. So going back to the beginning of the development of the game, mm-hmm. one of the ways I thought I could cheat around the 18-card limit was to use both sides of each card. Okay. I figured that would give me 36 planets that I could create that would have different abilities. And then when you play a planet, you get to look at both sides and decide, you know, in this game, this is the version of the planet that I want to use. And what we were able to do is basically put both versions of the planet on the same face of the card. So if you're looking at the card in sort of portrait, you could then flip it 180 or rotate it 180 degrees.
Oh, cool.
And now you have a different set of statistics, a different ability, and a different card description. So one of the actions, so I've talked about exploring is drawing new cards, colonizing, putting them into play. So there's an action called upgrade, where you pay the difference in cost and you rotate one of your planets, and now you get the new ability instead of the old ability.
So really, you're actually getting kind of like four times the real estate out of a card because you can rotate it, and then presumably you can also flip it.
No, when we decide to put both faces on the same side, then then they all have a standard back. They all have an identical back.
Okay.
So it makes it a lot less cumbersome to be, you know, shuffling and dealing and, you know,
making sure the lower side is up or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, yep, exactly.
I like that. That's clever, and it saves on printing and
yes.
artwork.
Yep. So let's see. We've covered explore, colonize, and upgrade. Mm-hmm. The next is produce, because all of the previous actions are going to cost you credits. So producing is a way of making all of your planets gaining credits from all the planets that you have in play. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's attacking, which we've talked about. So the thing that's interesting is the on your turn, you choose an action that you want to do, and you also choose a follow cost. Each of your opponents in turn order can do the same action if they pay you whatever follow cost you've decided. So, for example, I'll say I'm going to explore, and the follow cost is 2. So I pay my one credit to draw a card. Mm-hmm. The next player, if they want to explore as well, in addition to the 1 credit for the card, they have to give me 2 of their credits.
Is there any limit on how high you can set the follow cost? And is there any reason to set it low? Well, I guess if you set it low, people are more likely to pay it.
Yes. Okay. If a player does not follow, then they get a free credit from the bank. So this is sort of, on the one hand, it's a consolation prize for, for example, you're colonizing, but I don't have any cards in my hand. So I can't follow. At least I get a credit, so I don't fall too far behind the rest of the game. But it also means that if you're doing something like producing to get credits, if you set the follow cost too high, then someone else might say, well, if I produce, I'll get 3 credits, but I have to give 2 of them to you and I only get 1, then I'm going to not follow, in which case I get that 1 that I would have gotten anyway.
That's an interesting brain puzzle to balance out as you're trying to decide how you want to do your turn. But at the same time, I might want to set my follow cost super high because I really don't want Johannes to get to do anything on my turn.
Yes. So the other restriction is that you cannot set the follow cost higher than the number of planets you have in play.
Hmm. So your tableau where your planets that you've explored are played is specific to you. You're not building a galaxy or a system in the middle of the table that everyone can move around. It's what you've explored.
Yes, that's correct. So the terminology that we have is you have your own personal galaxy, which is the planets that you have in front of you. Uh-huh. And each player's galaxy then makes up the entire universe.
Okay. I like that. That's clear.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the game, so the follow cost must be at least 1 and cannot be more than the number of planets you have. So at the beginning of the game, the follow cost is always going to be 1. But as soon as you get 2 planets, then you sort of ease into the decision of, do I want to charge 1 or 2 for this option? And you can certainly, especially for something like exploring, where players have to pay a credit to the bank to get the card in addition to whatever follow cost you set. You can look at the mm-hmm. board. Everyone's credits is public information. So you can look at the board and say, okay, if I set it at 2, then Johannes can follow me, but Anna cannot because she's only got 2 credits. So you can you set the same follow cost for everyone, but how you choose that number can impact which players are able to follow you and which players are not.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah, the following mechanic is is one of the 2 really sort of interesting and intricate parts of the game. And the other one is attacking. So attacking is the only action that other players cannot follow, but everyone is involved because there's 3 phases to attacking. So I'll walk you through it. The first phase is you declare, this is my planet I'm attacking with, and I'm targeting one of my opponent's planets. Mm-hmm. And that sort of lays out the groundwork, and the military value of those planets is sort of the base attacking and defensive values.
You said specifically one of my opponent's planets. It's one planet specifically, or one opponent specifically?
One planet specifically.
Okay.
And there are two ways that you can supplement the military value of the planet. The first is by discarding cards from your hand. So as you might imagine, in a game that only has 17 cards, cards are a very valuable resource. So using mm-hmm. them during an attack it's not something that you'll do often, but it's a piece of secret information that other players will get to see how many cards you're using, and they know that the range of value is between 2 and 6 in terms of the amount that that's going to affect the attacking or defensive value. So they could sort of guess if you put down 2 cards, well, you're going to have an additional 4 to maybe 10 or 11 points there.
It's kind of like our combat mechanic in Big Man. Reveal a number of cards with a hidden value, so you can sort of guess at what it is, but you don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So you have an idea. You can figure out what the range is, but you don't know what the actual number is. So each player has the option of using cards from their hand, and then simultaneously, each player will indicate how many credits they're going to use. Now, for the players that are not directly involved in the battle, the players that are not the attacking or defending player, mm-hmm. they don't reveal until the end which player they're supporting. So if there's 3 of us and I'm attacking you, I can see the third player may be using some unknown, fistful of coins and one of their cards, but it's not until we have already locked in how many resources we're going to use in the battle. That player then indicates whether they're supporting the attacker or supporting the defender. Hmm. So, there's a lot of interesting sort of psychology in trying to convince other players, okay, this is what I need you to do. But obviously they're also thinking for their own, to increase their own chances of winning as much as possible.
You are hitting so many notes in the design of this game that are things that we like. Like mm-hmm. I feel like there's just 4X already has Tom looking lasciviously at the Board Game Geek page.
It's true. I adore 4X games. Like the first board game that I played really was Battle Mist back then.
Yeah, that game was garbage.
I don't know if you ever played Battle Mist at all, Chip, but
it sucks.
It was Fantasy Flight. Fantasy Flight did Twilight Imperium, and then they tried to make a fantasy version of it with Battle Mist, and then they re-implemented it years later as Rune Wars.
Oh, okay.
And
it was crap and garbage.
Well, I mean, yeah, it wasn't great, like, from a design standpoint, but it has a place in my mind that is very deeply ingrained. And it did some cool stuff. I gotta give it credit.
Like, it was an early game to use, like, hex grid to generate.
Yeah, and
dynamic board and that kind of thing.
It had a very distinct and interesting way of generating that dynamic board that made generating the board a kind of a game in and of itself at the beginning. Huh. And it did some cool stuff with combat. But anyway, I love
it. It also was distinct in that it sucked and was bad.
Right. That's, the podcast is over. No. And then Eclipse is also one of my favorites. But the biggest problem I've always had with them is that other people aren't lunatics who want to dedicate their entire afternoon for a week running to one sprawling monster of a game and don't derive great delight from crawling up inch by inch on a tech tree. So being able to condense that experience down to 30 minutes and 18 cards is, it's got my jimmies all rustled in a good way.
Yeah, it's really been neat sort of bringing this game to different conventions and game groups and sort of pitching it to them to get them to play. Because as soon as I say it's a 4X game and it just uses 18 cards and it's over in under an hour, people are intrigued and they're like, well, I have to see this. Like,
yeah, that does. That's exactly what I would think if I came across this at Protospiel or something. Like, I've got to see what that is, even if it didn't sound, even if I don't like 4X, just to see it.
Yeah, there's sort of this, I'm not even sure if it's possible to do what you say, curiosity.
Exactly.
Are you a wizard?
I think Chip might be a wizard.
But what's really satisfying is after they play, they say, you know, either that was or was not what they were expecting. But it's an experience that they want to have again. One of my favorite things to see at the end of a play is at the end of people playing the game is so the way the game ends is if you have 15 victory points on your turn, then you can, you know, then you just basically declare victory. And the victory points come from the planets that you have in play, the credits that you have. Every 5 credits gives you 1 victory point, and also the universal rule card. So let me back up a little bit. So of the 18 cards, 17 of them are planets, and then the 18th card is a universal rule card, which is a 6 victory point token. And the player who contributed the most to the most recent successful attack will hold on to that card until there's another successful attack, and then it will go to whoever contributes the most resources to that attack.
Huh. So you were saying earlier that combat is a thing that you might not actually see all that often in a game. Did I hear that right?
Yes, it is actually. There are multiple sort of paths to victory. So there is an upgrade path where you could almost play this as a Euro. So I know people have described Eclipse as like the first 2/3 is like a pure Euro, and then the last third is sort of an Amerithrash game where you're attacking all of your opponents and you're breaking the alliances that you had and so on. So you can play an entire game and get to 15 victory points simply by upgrading your, colonizing lots of planets, upgrading them, and producing a lot of credits. But it's very difficult to do that without your opponents noticing. So at some point your opponents are going to say, so maybe for the first game within a game group you would play, and you would get to a point where someone says, oh, I've got 15 points, I won. But the next time they play, they're going to realize during the next round, if he upgrades this planet, then he'll have enough victory points to win. Therefore, one of us needs to attack him to either destroy one of his basic planets or downgrade another one of his planets, or just use up the resources that he has available, because credits can also convert into victory points at the end of the game.
There's a lot of that in... So I like the... First of all, it looks like he's going to win. One of us has to attack him. It reminds me a lot of in Coup, when you're getting close to having the maximum amount of credits, and this can either happen to you, or you can choose to let it happen if you don't want to draw the ire of other players by choosing to coup someone. You can just be like, well, on the next round, I have no choice. I will be a blunt weapon by whoever chooses to spend money, like in the expansion, spend money to change my or someone else's allegiance, and then I just have to coup on my next turn, and maybe it's not my fault. It's sort of that... In this case, it looks like you could be like, well, I don't want to attack you personally, but one of us has to.
Yes.
Or you're just going to take it away. It also reminds me of the only time I think I've ever done really well in... we've talked about this game like 30 times. Why can I never remember the name of it?
I don't know what game you're talking
about. It's the one I forget the name of all the time with Space. It's the one literally we've been talking about this whole time that's not his game.
Space Alert?
Nope.
Eclipse?
Come on. 4X Eclipse.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay, yeah.
I like how I'm mad at you for not... in Eclipse, the one time I think I ever did really well at it, it was when I was like, guys, I don't enjoy the combat mechanic in this game. like, I'm here to play the game with you, but I really don't want to interact with you all that much if I don't have to. Just let me fart around and explore and see what I can do with whatever, and I'm probably not going to win. And I destroyed everyone without ever having... I had maybe one minor combat, and now they don't let me do that anymore. So I don't play that game because it's not fun.
I wonder why we don't.
But yeah, that you could win potentially without combat. I was wondering, how swingy is the universal rule card? Like, how, what do the victory points usually look like toward the end?
So you need in a 3-player game, you need 15 victory points to win, and it ranges a little bit based on the number of players.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be between it'll be around like maybe 12 to 15 based on how many players you have. So obviously at 12, then the universal rule card is, represents half of the number of credits that you would need to win. But one of the important things to note is that you can get the universal rule card even if you are not the person initiating the attack.
Oh, sure. Just by that throw in with someone
exactly.
else's combat.
So if you declare the attack, you need to be mindful that someone might support you, and if they put in more resources than you, then they're going to end up with the 6 victory point token. Now you can get the universal rule card fairly early on in the game. So I've seen some games where someone attacks, just during the first round, after everyone has a planet in play, they say, oh, I've got the biggest planet. People don't have a lot of resources to spend in an attack.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just going to go and like beat you down with my planet. There's one planet in the game, the basic planet, that has I can't remember its cost, but its cost is either 3 or 4 credits, so it's very easy to play early on in the game, and it has a very strong military it has a military value of 6, and the maximum of any planet is 10. So it's a very strong planet. However, it's called the card name is called Pessimistic. And it has a single rule, which is you cannot win.
Oh, no.
Now, the thing about this planet, though, is all the planets can be upgraded.
Uh-huh.
So once you upgrade this planet, which is very expensive, but once you upgrade it, that text is no longer applies.
You can now win, but it must be with 18 points or more.
Yeah, We played, I think that there's been a version of the Pessimistic Planet in the game since the very beginning, because one of the effects of the restriction to only having 18 cards is I don't mess around with sort of subtle graded effects where I could say, okay, I'm going to have 3 cards, I'll have sort of the weak version, and then the average version, and the strong version.
Uh-huh.
I just jump to, okay, what's the most, what's the most extreme version of this card that I could come up with?
Okay.
And so every card, when you look at it, is going to strike you as overpowered. But it's okay, because every other card is also overpowered.
If everything's overpowered, nothing's
exactly.
overpowered. I like that.
It sounds like that kind of ducks the common criticism of 4X is where the first bit is just shuffling your tokens around, getting in position, and then you actually get to play the game in the back two
yeah.
thirds of it, which
yeah,
is kind of
yeah,
neat.
Yeah.
Do all of the cards have special rules, or is it just a few?
Almost all of them. There is an exception. There is a pair of planets, so that's a base planet and its upgraded version,
uh-huh.
called the Little Moneymaker and the Large Moneymaker. And they are the only cards that do not have any abilities.
Mm.
All the other ones do. So, yeah. So, I'm sorry. I got distracted. We were talking about the Pessimistic Planet. So, it is possible for to play a complete game and to get to the victory condition without attacking. But as soon as someone does attack successfully, then that there are 6 victory points that are sort of available for people to grab.
Right.
And then it becomes a lot more dynamic because you have to sort of bear in mind, you know, who do you need to attack next in order to stop them from winning? Because you can only declare victory on your turn.
Oh.
So if you can knock someone down, then even if during the rest of the round they get back up to 15 points, there's sort of a built-in timer mechanism where you say, okay, if the player that's 2 steps away from me is about to win, I can collude with the next player and say, tell you what, I will produce. And so the 2 of us can build up our resources. And then on your turn, you attack him and I'll have the resources to support you. So you'll see a lot of negotiation like that towards the end of the game.
I imagine it would be incredibly frustrating to be at or over the number of points you need for victory, but have gotten that way on a follow instead of on your turn and just have to wait knowing that you're not going to make it to your turn that way. Someone's going to attack you and you're going to
be both. Generally, most players will approach the victory threshold around the same time. And this actually brings me back to a story that I was leading up to before. One of the things I like to see is at the end of the game, one player declares victory and wins. And in almost every playtest I've seen, each other player at the table says, hang on, I want to tell you about how I was about to win. And so the next person will say, oh man, if it was just gotten to me, I would have produced. And because I have this special planet that lets me get a better return converting credits to victory points, I would have had enough to win.
Did people like that or did they find it frustrating?
I think the people have really enjoyed it because the thing that it drives you to is, oh man, I almost won in a short game where I made a lot of significant decisions. And if I had done something different, like 2 turns ago, if I had followed that exploration to get a card instead of not following to get a credit so that I could upgrade, or if I had upgraded this planet instead of that planet, then I could have won. So it's almost like you get the addictive quality of a game of Magic the Gathering, where at the end of, after you finish a duel with another player, everyone always looks at their top card and they say, oh, if I had been able to hold on for one more round, here's how the game would have played out differently. And that really drives people back to the table and to say, I want to play again.
Well, but you've got a nice advantage over Magic 2 here in that at the end of the game, neither player has had to mortgage their house in order to keep up with the releases. You know?
Even if everyone has a deck, they still all only have 18 cards.
Right.
And it came with a convenient carrying case.
So, I mean, we're like 2 up on WotC now.
Now, one more thing that I wanted to let you know about Universal Rule is if you've seen any of the preview images, you've seen the 17 different planets, and I want to point out that the artwork was actually done by my wife.
I noticed that.
She also did the cover illustration for Smoke and Mirrors, but the planets have really been a different style of art. Much more in Smoke and Mirrors, it was sort of a 1920s Houdini poster effect that she was going for. And these planets just came out great. They're there are a lot of different styles of planets. My wife is a big sci-fi geek. She's into Star Wars and Star Trek. So the idea of envisioning different planets that had different geological aspects to them and we're in different, modes of evolution. So some of them are very green and sort of, you know, nature has taken over, and other ones are very developed by different societies. So they're dark, but they've got a lot of, artificial light and lasers and satellites and that thing. So I want to certainly include a, there have been times when Jason and I have been talking about the game from a gameplay mechanic standpoint, and then we would just stop and look at the cards and just be overwhelmed by between the graphic design of the game and the artwork on the planets. It's really just sort of breathtaking.
The cards do look really nice, and I was impressed when I saw your wife's name on it when you linked us to the Board Game Geek page earlier, because I know we talked about before Smoke and Mirrors came out that she'd done some of the pretty simple line drawings for Chroma Cubes, and that she was doing some artwork, but at the time I think we hadn't seen it yet for Smoke and Mirrors, and then when we saw it, I was pretty impressed, and so it looks like she's quite a good artist, but it also looks like she's improved quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah.
And as I said before, last time or two times ago you were on, that I'm very envious. I think we're both envious of you, not just knowing, but being married to someone who can do your game artwork for you, where we have Tom really soldiering away, and more credit than I give him is due for the stuff he does what is it you're using? Vizio for Big Man? But to have an artist would be just a wonderful thing.
And more credit to artists, because that's a freaking lot of work.
It's a ton of work.
I can't even imagine trying to do it in Photoshop.
Yeah, it's really great. We're actually we're working together on a word game that I run on Twitter called A Little Alliteration.
I've jumped in on that a couple times. I've enjoyed it.
So each day during the week, or each work day, Monday through Friday, I give out two different clues. So they're basically word puzzles. And every Wednesday, she actually draws a sketch of an illustration for one of the clues.
Nice.
So I think one of the more recent ones, the solution was, mountain mouse mouth. So she drew this really adorable little rodent on top of a mountain, and like he's got his, mouth open with fangs, and there's a big arrow pointing toward his mouth. And there's one guy on Twitter who wasn't even playing the game, but just saw the illustration and said, "I have no idea what this is about, but I have this really strong desire to feed this rat."
I could talk about this forever, but I don't, we're already a little over our time, and I don't want to waste your time. But I would like to plug the Kickstarter one more time, which starts, it will have started by the time this episode goes up.
What are you talking about? We do this live. This is a live show.
So it's already started. And I wanted to ask, if there's anything else just great that you wanted to point out, or anything else you have coming up, but also if you could briefly tell us about the other games. I'm assuming there's another two wallet games in this one. Is that still happening?
No, actually, this year, each month has been a single wallet game.
Oh, okay.
However, next year, so going into 2017, Buttonshy is going to be releasing 12 wallet games over the course of the year, but they're going to do it they're going back to the, I want to call it the Smoke and Mirrors model, although that's very egocentric of me, of having quarterly Kickstarters. So once every 3 months.
I imagine once a month must have been insane for Jason and whoever else has to work on these
things. Yes, I think he's crazy for doing it, but it's been very successful. So in 2017. There'll be one Kickstarter campaign every 3 months, and that Kickstarter campaign will include three wallet games. But back to sort of the present/future/ past, depending on when you're listening to this. So Universal Rule is going to be on Kickstarter from November 1st to November 11th. And you can find out about it by going to buttonshy.com or by following me on Twitter. I'm at @_flyingsheep. That's T-H-E, the underscore symbol, F-L-Y-I-N-G-S-H-E-E-P. And that's where I could be found.
Great. And out of curiosity, is Smoke and Mirrors still available for purchase somewhere?
Yes, it is. You can go to buttonshy.com and you can get that. There is a possibility that there might be some special bundle deal with the Kickstarter, but that hasn't been determined yet.
Okay. And for our listeners, we very much enjoyed the Buttonshy Wallet games and the games of chips that we've played so far. So that's definitely worth checking out. There's actually an episode of us playing North South East Quest on the air up on
I believe
our website.
That was the episode that featured a small chubby boy eating tuna salad.
To be probably. Fair, anytime we make up a story on the spot, it seems to feature a small chubby boy. Not always tuna salad, but that just seems to be our go-to, which is probably says something about us. We'll not dig too deeply into what it is that says about us.
It says we're awesome.
That's sure. We'll say that. So you can find Chip in those places he said, buttonshygames.com, @_flyingsheep. And did you say your website? Is that still a thing?
It is. It hasn't been updated, so Twitter is probably the best place.
All right. And you can always contact us on Twitter @mildlyalarming.
On email @mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
On the website at I'm an idiot. On the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or on facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow.
Or just by clapping your hands and thinking a happy thought.
We can hear all the clapping all the time. It's the worst.
It's very distracting. Stop clapping.
But thank you, Chip, for coming on the show.
It was my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for doing it. We'll talk to you soon. Hello, America. Do you remember the first time you beheld the vast prairies of our majestic nation? Do you remember the swell of pride in your chest when you laid eyes on those endless fields of wheat and barley, amber waves gently stirred by the breezes that came down from those purple mountains? Well, friends, I'm sad to say that those fields are no more. Oh, the grain is still there, and the breezes still blow, but that lovely amber color is no more. Thanks a lot, Obama. Fortunately, there's a solution, thanks to American ingenuity. With my patented grain paint, you can restore that beautiful shade of golden brown that George Washington sang about when he crossed the Mississippi, becoming our first president. Just a quick coat of paint, and our nation will have one of its national treasures back. And don't worry about your newly amber waves of grain withering and turning to gray mush because you smeared poison on them. There's a very good chance that that won't happen to some of you. Well, a good chance. At least a reasonable chance. A chance, technically. Help restore America. Pick up a can of amber grain paint and get to work today. And keep your eyes open for our other fine products. Purple Mountain Paint, Sky and Spacious Inning Braces, and Multidirectional Plain Fruiteners. It's what the Founding Fathers would have wanted.
Welcome back to the Mustard Laser Podcast. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And you're listening to us talk to you on the internet.
About mustard.
About and lasers.
And mustard lasers.
And laser mustard.
Again, with the mic hitting.
They make me so angry.
Yeah.
Well, I just have to punch them with my fists.
Your meaty fists?
They're so meaty.
The meatest.
It's because I wrap them in bacon every morning.
That sounds hygienic.
And by noon, they smell.
Takes that long.
Yeah.
Got cold hands.
Yeah.
It refrigerates the bacon from the inside.
But we're here. We're here. We're on the internet. We're talking to you about how much we like Chip Beauvais.
Just so much.
He's such a good guy.
He's a kind gentleman.
Chip Beauvais has been known to feed orphans right out of his own mouth.
Wow.
Just lets him have some of that chewed food of his.
It's very kind of him.
And very scary. But we're also talking about the hit new indie RPG. I don't know if it's new or a hit. The indie RPG Everyone is John that we played a couple of weeks ago.
Wherein everyone is John.
Everybody is John. All of the players are John. They're all John. Everybody's John. And we're going to talk to you about it a little bit, tell you what we thought, and provide you a link in the show notes to the rules so you can play it if you want.
Just making a note of that.
I already put it in there.
Oh, nice.
I already made the show notes.
Cool.
Yeah.
Forget I said anything, man.
Everybody forgot it already. Who are you? Are you Chip Beauvais?
I am.
Wow. That's not true.
I once rescued a burning school bus full of orphans from the bottom of a mine shaft.
How did it get down there in the first place?
It crashed into the mine elevator. They went on a field trip.
That's a pretty big mine elevator to take a whole school bus down the mine.
I mean, like, they bring other vehicles up and down. Why not?
What vehicles could they possibly bring up and down?
Like pickup trucks and stuff.
All they bring up and down are haggard mules. That's it.
I saw a video of a salt mine. It was freaky, but they were driving cars around down there.
Huh. I think the Haggard Mules would be a good, like, folk band name or folk band name.
Or like, it could be punk. That's a kind of a punk band sort of name.
We are the Haggard Mules. Yeah, okay. I'd buy that.
Yeah. All, you know, studs and leather jackets and whatnot.
Leather studs on their metal jackets.
It sounds uncomfortable.
It sounds excruciating. You'd pinch a nip.
Yeah, it's...
Just one, though. The right one's fine, but it's that left
it's
one.
It's the left one.
That really just gets caught between the pleats.
It's not like you have a lot of experience.
Wearing a metal jacket with leather studs on it?
Yeah.
Listen, my high school days were different than you think they were.
Okay. So when Everyone is John, Everyone is John, as previously mentioned, but it is a sort of pen and paper, but you barely even need the pen and paper RPG, where y'all sit around a table or a room or what have you.
One player is the dungeon master, y'all.
Yeah, one player is the game master. In the rules, that player is described as John. That gets a little bit confusing because they also control the world around them, but they sort of represent John, and they're your typical game master. Each player, rewind a little bit, the John is just a bumbling idiot. He's not real good at anything in life. And he also hears voices. Every other player is one of the voices that John hears in his head. And so to begin the game, you will choose a name for your voice, which is not something that we did when we played, but it is in the wiki, so I guess you could do that. You choose two or three skills that your voice has that others don't. If you choose two, you begin the game with 10 willpower points, which we'll explain momentarily. If you choose three, you begin the game with fewer. I think we said it was eight.
I think it was seven.
Or seven willpower points. And then you also choose an obsession. Your obsession will be kept secret from the other players until you complete it at least once, but you have to run it by the game master. And your obsession could be something like eat a lot of candy, or it could be something more difficult like... drive a flaming school bus into a salt mine. And depending on how difficult it is, it'll be rated as a level one, a level two, or a level three obsession. What were you saying?
So for example, my...
Oh, I was going to make an example.
Oh,
go ahead.
You can do the example.
I'll do another one.
Okay.
We'll have two
so
examples.
So for example, my voice's skills were... I don't remember the first one, but one of them was good at making dogs like me.
Yeah.
Like, so I got a bonus to any rolls if I had to make a dog be my friend. And my obsession was give life-affirming pep talks to children.
Yeah.
And so those were what I was trying to get John to do.
You could have a voice named Harambe, and your skills could be being freakishly strong, and you can eat, like, hundreds of bananas at a single go, and your obsession could be giving gentle hugs to small children. You know, that could be a thing.
That could be a thing that you do. It's a game that really encourages off-color humor, I think, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to link to the wiki, is that correct? Or did you just link to the image?
I linked to the Imgur album.
Okay. Well, there's a wiki page for this. That has an example playthrough that is quite a bit more off color than ours was. It got real dark real fast.
Yeah. But and so then as you start playing, everyone is John. The Games Master describes where John wakes up for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you all bid willpower from your pool for who wants to be in control. Whoever bids the most spends it and gets control.
Everyone else who bid and didn't win gets theirs back.
Gets theirs back. And if there's a tie, you roll off. To see
with
who
D6s, gets. Each of you should
with,
have a
with
D6.
With D6ing, yeah. Then you start telling John what to do as your voice, trying to get him to complete your obsession. If you encounter something that an ordinary human might fail at, you have to roll a D6, and you succeed on a 6, you fail on anything else, unless it's one of your skills, in which case you succeed on a 3.
Also, you could spend willpower points to add 1 to your yep. dice roll. So you could conceivably spend a lot of them and have a guaranteed success. But since there's a finite number of willpower points,
right.
you probably don't want to do that most of the time.
Every time you fail a roll, or every time 20 minutes in game time passes without anything really happening to John, you have to have a roll or a bid for voices to take control of John, and everybody gets to bid again, just like they did at the start. And then whoever takes control of John is in charge, and John starts doing that stuff instead.
Additionally, everyone gets back 1 willpower token when control is about to switch. So before yes. the bid, when someone's like, okay, you did a thing that caused control to switch, everyone gets 1 willpower point back, and then you bid.
The game ends if John is killed in some way, which is more likely than you might expect, or if everybody runs out of willpower and none of the voices have it in them to take control of John anymore.
Additionally, if because John is very easily bored, I guess, mm-hmm. if he ever does anything that takes more than 5 minutes.
Is it 5 or 20?
I think it was 5.
Oh, geez.
He falls asleep. So if you take a bus ride, if you take a cab ride, if you ride a Ferris wheel, he falls asleep. And when John falls asleep, there is also immediately a bid for control yep. of John.
So the game is, it depends a lot on having players who are willing to dive into the ridiculous world you're about to be in and are willing to mock those with multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
As a way
well,
of
no, just this
evening.
One. Just the one. Guy.
Yeah. But if you're willing to go there, it's pretty entertaining. Our John that we played with had a glorious adventure involving bicycles, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for a soccer game. Like,
wait, when were there bicycles?
I might be making up the bicycles. Making his way to a soccer game, charging a playground full of children.
Being beaten by an old woman with a bag at a crosswalk.
Explaining to the children that they really should shop around for the best rate on their mortgage.
Being very, 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 very creepy to a taxi driver.
I think there was blood at one point. Like, he got cut up by something. I don't remember what, though.
He got in a fight and lost a tooth.
Losing a tooth. Hiding in a, I think it was a Starbucks bathroom.
Yeah, and several times. No, the Starbucks bathroom is in the example. One. Oh, I don't think gotcha. That happened in ours. He tried to hide. He didn't make it in just a restaurant bathroom.
And I think he wound up arrested at the end of the game.
He also fell asleep in public several times.
Yep.
My clever attempt at winning, which worked, so I guess it was a clever attempt at winning, mm-hmm. Was that my obsession was sleeping in public places, mm-hmm. which meant that anything anyone did that caused him to sleep in a public place gained me a point. And in addition, if I got control of John, if it seemed reasonable or not, I would just lay down and take a nap.
Johannes is fun to play games with. No, but it's a lot of fun. It's very light. It's very fast. It's the GM doesn't need a lot of experience running role-playing games, I didn't feel like,
no.
to keep it rolling, because you just need to be able to be able to react to, is there a park nearby? Are there children I can talk to?
Yeah, and
just,
I feel like the most difficult thing for them to do was set up the initial
yeah.
space, which wasn't all that hard.
It's easy enough to be time. Like, you know, John wakes up in his apartment. That's where you are. Oh, no.
And maybe seeing a situation stagnating enough that you can be like, and now the police have arrived, or right. like just bring another character in so that something happens yeah. rather than just I'm in a paint store.
Mm-hmm. The players don't need a ton of RPG experience either, because there's not a lot of mechanics to work with.
Right.
It's just sort of try to talk John into doing your obsession, which depending on your obsession might be really easy. Like mine, which was give pep talks to small children, involved just constantly asking, is there a playground nearby? How about an elementary school?
What about dogs? Are there dogs?
Can I talk to a dog, maybe? Now, since the other players didn't know my obsession, they were giving me some weird looks. I'm like, where are the children
at? I just need to find children or dogs.
Yeah, I was getting some funny looks there, which was the goal. Everybody laughed. It was fun. We had a good time.
We had a good time with it.
Yeah, so if you're into light RPGs, I think Everybody is John is a pretty good time.
I feel like with any game like this that is so open-ended, the game you play will vary wildly depending on who you're playing with, and there is maybe less so in Everyone is John than in something like Apples to Apples, but there's the similar possibility that someone just playing a game, playing the game like by the rules, mm-hmm. could make an otherwise entertaining game extremely, extremely sure. unpleasant for everyone.
Sure.
And not by being deliberately unpleasant, but just by being like, but why would he do that? Mm-hmm. I don't think a person would want to hug a strange child. That seems weird. I don't get it. There are those people. Mm-hmm. I recommend you not play this game with those people. Otherwise, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's a pretty good time. We weren't able to find an attribution to which person or company made this, if it was, on the image we found. So if you know, if you are that person or can put us in touch with them, do so, please.
It was created by Michael B. Sullivan. It's right here at the top of the wiki page.
Well, I didn't read that paragraph, Johannes. So why didn't you tell me that before I made a fool of myself on the internet?
I don't know. It links to a page that is signed by someone else, though. So from 2014.
Oh. Maybe it's not Michael B. Sullivan.
It's an alumni website page, but it's signed by Simon Chase, Systems Administrator. So who knows?
Well, at any rate, maybe if you are Michael B. Sullivan, if that is your real name, contact us. We'd like to talk to you about your game. But, yeah, do we have anything else to say about Everyone is John?
Not really. It's worth a play.
It's fun.
We think we might, if we feel like doing the work, and by that I mean if I feel like doing the work, set up a mic and try to do an on-the-air play with some others.
Our friends Frothgar and Harambe.
Mm-hmm. Frolvonimus.
Shemp.
Kalupta Chops.
Svalborp.
That's all I got for now.
It's probably for the best. It's not a great bit.
I liked Kalupta Chops, though.
It's pretty good.
Well, this has been the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Thanks for listening. If you have other silly names you would like us to read on the air, you could let us know on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You could let us know on email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You could do that on the comments section in the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or on facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow. You can rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or Google Play Music.
Or you can go over to Chip Beauvais' house and talk to him, and he'll get your message to us because we're best friends. He's our friend. We like Chip.
And if you're an orphan, apparently he will pre-chew food and then spit it into your open mouth.
Wow. Isn't he a great guy?
He's a great guy.
Good old Chip.
Well, we'll see you next week on the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
Adios.
Toodles.
Everybody hates ironing. It takes forever for the thing to heat up, and it puts steam all over the air in your house, and you have to have that doom little bird thing on your table gets covered in burn marks that look like fat pizza slices. Plus, since you're ironing your shirt, you can't wear it, so you're apt to burn your gut. It's a thing. It happens to people. That's where I come in. Hi. I'm Harveth the Mighty, champion of the Great Wolf, and I'm here to tell you about Harveth the Mighty's ironing horde. Instead of ironing that shirt yourself, why not hire a vast legion of furious, filthy barbarians to do it for you? We'll descend on your house like a biblical plague, pillaging the countryside for 100 leagues and putting any resistance to the sword. The bards will sing of our terrible wrath, and the puny men of your city will tremble at our names for 1,000 generations. And you? You'll have a real smooth shirt for it. Better than doing it yourself, right? So give us a call and try Harveth the Mighty's Ironing Horde today!